Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Navajo Autumn by R. Allen Chappelle. Narrated by Kaipo Schwab. 1. Spider Woman. Just outside Farmington, New Mexico, the San Juan River swings in close to the highway to pick up a tributary at the mouth of a wide, nearly dry stream bed. La Plata, it's called. Not much more than a trickle, usually, though it can be more if they get any rain up country. The day they found Patsy Greyhorse's body, it was just a trickle. Nothing extraordinary in that. Navajos dead beside the highway are not uncommon in that country. Drunk, some of them, wandering around in traffic at night, their eyes not reflecting the headlights like a deer or a horse. Three things took this particular instance out of the ordinary. Patsy Greyhorse was not a Navajo. She had not been drinking, and she was very highly placed in the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Thomas Begay, on the other hand, who was found sleeping under the bridge nearby, was a Navajo, drunk, unfortunately, and a very unsavory character. It was only natural that the sheriff's deputy should immediately arrest him and, by order of his superiors, cause Thomas to be taken to the county hospital for blood tests and evaluation. He arrived even before the remains of Patsy Greyhorse. Thomas Begay, at 29 years old, had never been inside a hospital even when being born. That unnoteworthy event took place in a summer hogan north of Tuba City. While his present surroundings were strange, the smell of the hospital was familiar, putting him in mind of the BIA dormitories and classrooms that were a sinister part of his childhood. Government school. He wouldn't wish it on a dog. He had suffered no more than his father before him, of course, but that had not made it any easier for Thomas Begay. He couldn't see any good coming from this county hospital, even though he had a fearsome headache, vision blurring in rhythm with each labored breath, trouble getting enough air, as though a steel band was drawn tight about his chest. Surely, he thought, a man of 29 couldn't be having a heart attack. There had been innumerable hangovers, but nothing like this. He was sober enough now to know he had been arrested, but was still uncertain as to why. No matter. He had been arrested on a number of occasions, and while never pleasant, he had come to accept it as the way in which he paid for the life he led, which is to say, a very bad life indeed, if you were to listen to talk on the reservation. Thomas Begay lived with his ex-mother-in-law, a thing hard to understand if you're white. Should you be Navajo, however, it would be so horrific, so unfathomable as to generate outrage and disgust of monumental proportions. In the old times, a man was not allowed even to look upon his mother-in-law, let alone speak to her. And here was Thomas Begay, living with Lucy Tallwoman, whose daughter had left after one pitiful year of marriage. The girl, in shame, had left that part of the reservation and was said to be working in a back-alley bar in Gallup. She refused to discuss her mother or ex-husband, even when drinking, which she often was. It should be mentioned that Lucy Tallwoman was an unusually good-looking woman for her age, which was probably no more than 38. A cheerful, hard-working weaver of blankets in the traditional manner, blankets bringing extremely high collector prices, making Lucy Tallwoman quite well off, relatively speaking. She did not drink. She had borne her daughter out of wedlock when she was 18, the result of an unfortunate infatuation with a white music teacher at boarding school. That her daughter was part white was undeniable. It had been an unlucky mix in most people's view, as the daughter was quite plain and given to fits of depression. Thomas Begay, a fine-looking young man and one of great wit and charm when sober, attributed his young wife's moodiness to this white blood and was prone to make excuses for her on that basis. All this, according to the local trader, who was well up on the situation, having had an eye for Lucy Tallwoman and her blankets himself. Thomas Begay sat handcuffed to the chromium arm of an emergency room lounge chair, mesmerized by a small brown spider that was lowering itself from the ceiling to the potted plant beside him. The deputy had hurried away to look for the ER nurse, as there was no one at the check-in desk when they arrived.
"Hurry up. Hurry up,"
Thomas thought vaguely as he watched the spider.
"That's the white way."
It was not a common spider, and Thomas Begay was trying to focus on it. Something about the way it hovered there at eye level, twirling this way and that on its silver strand, made him think of Spider-Woman and the strange things his grandfather had told him as a child.
"Is that you, Spider-Woman?" Thomas whispered, peering blearily at the little creature. "Have you come for me?"
He leaned over the arm of the chair to better hear what the Spider-Woman might have to say. As he put his full weight on the chair arm, he couldn't help but notice that the weld holding it to the frame was not really welded at all, but had broken loose at some time in the past and was now held together only by the tension of the frame's curvature. Thomas Begay studied this new development, carefully adjusting his weight back and forth, watching the weld separate at the nearly indiscernible hairline crack. It finally dawned on him that indeed Spider-Woman had come for him, and that he had best be cooperating. Putting all his weight against the arm, he slipped off the steel ring and sat looking at his cuffed hand, now in his lap. "Thank you, Spider-Woman," he said quietly, rising unsteadily to his feet. His head felt much better while he was standing, and his breath came more easily, too. Looking both ways down the hall, he put the manacled hand in his jacket pocket and moved away, opposite the direction taken by the deputy. Coming out the back entrance of the hospital into the morning light, Thomas Begay's eyes fell upon the patrol car. Surely the keys wouldn't. But they were. And as he pulled out of the parking lot, he shook a finger in the rearview mirror and said, "You see how it is when you hurry up all the time?" The hospital stands at the edge of town on a hill above the river, and across the river, over the bridge, lie more than 25,000 square miles of the Navajo Reservation, possibly the largest Indian reservation in the world. The tribal council now refers to it as the Navajo Nation. Older Indians still refer to it as Dinibikeya, Navajo Country, but young people just call it the Rez. Even today, a person can become lost in its vastness, disappear, so to speak, should they be of a mind. Thomas Begay drove very slowly in that overly cautious manner drunk people assume when trying to appear sober. As he crossed the bridge, he noticed the water was low, exposing large piles of driftwood which had collected against the buttresses, including a few cottonwood trees of considerable size. Navajos, as a rule, are not good swimmers, and Thomas hated the very thought of it. The cold water caused him to suck in his breath, though it was quite shallow, 4 feet at the most. Easing along underneath the bridge until he reached the driftwood, he selected the broken-off top of a cottonwood tree that still had some upper branches and even leaves attached. Pushing it out into the river, he floated alongside, his body submerged, his head hidden in the leaves, the toes of his tennis shoes bouncing softly along the rocky bottom. Far away in the distance, he could hear the faint wail of sirens. He smiled to himself through chattering teeth. "They will search every arroyo from the river to the bluffs before they think of the water." And of course, he was right. Charlie Yazzie was investigating the disappearance of 4 sheep and an Angora goat over in Hunter's Wash when the call came from headquarters, touching off the horn alarm on his vehicle. He would not ordinarily have been called out for missing sheep, except that the complaint had come from his grandmother, Mary Plenty Goats, who had specifically requested her grandson. Sue Hanagarney, who was on the switchboard at the time, had gone to high school with Charlie and thought it would be a fine joke to put the report through on the air. "Yes, Charlie, your grandmother says Samuel Shorthair already came out, but that he can't find his ass with both hands. She wants those animals back. The goat is due to kid out any time, and it's that good one you bought her at the fair last fall." Sue Hanagarney was laughing so hard now she had to turn off the microphone, but not before Charlie heard Pete Fish in the background. "This is a big one, Charlie. Show them what you can do." Charlie would hear about this for a while. Charlie often talked about the big one, the case that would someday come along and make legal services sit up and take notice, the one that would be his ticket into the law offices where he rightly belonged. Graduating law school at the University of New Mexico the previous fall, Charlie had found the only thing available on the reservation was this special investigator position. Just another fancy name for a legal department gopher as far as Charlie was concerned. "Legal staff's full up," said the interviewer, a heavy-set Bitterwater Clan woman with thick glasses. "We'll give you a call as soon as something turns up. Just hang in there." It had been nearly a year now, and Charlie was still hanging. What made the situation even more depressing was that he had virtually no options. Interviewing with several private firms in Farmington had shown there was little chance of an Indian being hired outside the reservation. White clients would be leery of an Indian attorney, and the Indians, of course, would avail themselves of the legal services offered by the tribe. This was the dilemma facing many graduating Navajo professionals. That was just the way it was. But Charlie didn't have to like it. Sue Hanegarney had been much more serious the second time she called. She had given him everything they had on Patsy Greyhorse and told him about Thomas Begay escaping in the deputy sheriff's patrol unit. Charlie could tell she was excited. "There's an interagency meeting in Farmington in 1 hour, and you're the only one close enough to get there in time. The boss says go for it. And Charlie," she added with a touch of awe in her voice, "this really might be the big one." Interagency meeting meant the feds would be there, along with the state patrol, the sheriff's office, of course, and probably the local police, too. Charlie wondered if the sheriff would have the nerve to show up himself or send a deputy, maybe even the one that let Thomas Begay escape. Thomas Begay? Again? It had been only last week that he had given him a friendly warning about driving without a license. It had been on a back road on the reservation between Lucy Tallwoman's camp and the trading post. Charlie hadn't wanted to make a big deal of it. Technically, Thomas really hadn't been driving at all, just passed out in the truck, which was nosed over in the ditch beside the road. He had known Thomas a long time, had, in fact, always liked him. Like Sue Hanegarney and himself, Thomas had gone to school at the same government boarding facilities. He had been one of the brightest boys in their class and an all-state quarterback. It just seemed that nothing ever turned out right for Thomas. He had knocked around the reservation for the last few years, working as a mechanic, then construction on several government projects. After marrying a girl no one knew from over around Shiprock, he took to doing some serious drinking. A year later, he was separated and living with his mother-in-law. "Phew," Charlie thought, rubbing his forehead. "You just never know." Thomas Begay didn't seem the type. He glanced at his watch, reaching down to hit the flashers, kicking it up to 70, which he thought he could get away with, at least on the reservation. Charlie was late, despite all, and ran up the steps of the federal building and into the conference room in time to hear Sheriff's Deputy Dud Schott telling the assemblage how Thomas Begay had wrenched the arm off a lounge chair in order to make his escape, using car keys he had obviously lifted from Dud's belt on the way into the hospital. Dud's face was livid, and his little pig eyes darted from person to person during the telling as if daring anyone to question any part of it. One of the FBI agents, a small but distinguished-looking man in a three-piece pinstripe, held up a hand and asked if the keys to the handcuffs had been on the car ring. Dud beamed triumphantly and said, "You bet your ass they weren't," digging in his uniform pocket and producing the keys in question. "That navvy will be wearing those bracelets for a while, I expect." The federal agent, nodding thoughtfully, stood up and, noticing Charlie, motioned him to a chair at the end of the table. "So, gentlemen, let me reiterate briefly what we have here so far, and I must say it isn't much." The agent went over the sheriff's report, calling to their attention that Patsy Greyhorse was a Sioux woman, recently appointed by the BIA to look into certain dealings within the Navajo tribe. She was an expert on water rights and acquisition, and was to have delivered a report to a tribal conference the previous night in Window Rock. She had last been seen at her motel, where she was to freshen up before meeting acquaintances for lunch. Her body had been spotted by a passing tourist from Ohio, who had stopped at 6:15 that morning to relieve himself beside the La Plata Bridge. How she had wound up over 100 miles to the north was just one of the unanswered questions. There would be an information package for each of them at the end of the conference, including a preliminary coroner's report, pictures, including file photos of Thomas Begay, and more background on Patsy Greyhorse. The agent asked if there were any further questions, looking slightly irritated when Charlie Yazzie held up his hand. "Yes?"
"Excuse me, I arrived late. Could you tell me how close Thomas Begay was to the body when apprehended?"
The federal agent pointed a finger at Dud Schott, who frowned as he looked over at Charlie, whom he knew slightly and considered much too uppity for an Indian.
He was passed out under the bridge when I found him, maybe 10-15 feet from the body. But he had blood on his shirt, and his face was scratched. The deputy hesitated. It's all in the report.
The thought of an Indian being a special investigator with a law degree annoyed Dud, who had barely made it through the New Mexico Police Academy, even with the help of his wife's cousin, who was on the examining board. He and Charlie had bumped heads several times in the past when Dud had been harassing Indians around town. The Indians referred to him as Deputy Dog and laughed behind his back. Dud knew Charlie had no jurisdiction outside the reservation, just as Dud had very little inside. The federal agent in charge dismissed the meeting with a final notation that Washington was quite concerned and expected no stone to be left unturned. Dud Schott caught up with Charlie in the parking lot.
"Where you reckon that little bastard Begay will head for?"
He was wheezing from the short run across the lawn. Dud didn't care for Indians in general, and it irritated him to have to call on one for help. That back-to-the-blanket son-of-a-bitch Thomas Begay would pay for making him out to be a fool. Charlie stopped and looked Dud square in his fat face, causing Dud to turn even redder.
"The reservation," he said quietly, turning his back on him.
As Charlie drove off, Dud was still standing in the parking lot, red-faced and glaring.
"No talking sons of bitches," he wheezed.
Charlie really didn't know exactly where Thomas Begay might go for sure, but it would be somewhere on the reservation, all right. That's where all Navajos head when they're in trouble. He didn't mind Dud knowing. Dud had little jurisdiction there. Only federal and tribal officers held any real authority on the reservation. Lucy Tallwoman patted her old father's knee as they drove away from the supermarket.
"Well, we got everything you like," she said hopefully in Navajo. "Strawberry cream soda, canned tomatoes, and Oreo cookies," enumerating these last items in English, as that was easier. The old man gave no sign that he heard or approved of the purchases. He was nearly 75 years old and of that contrary frame of mind old people sometimes fall into. She had been late this morning, picking him up for their regular Sunday outing, and he was not in the mood to overlook it.
"Look there," she gestured. "Someone has brought a horse and wagon to town. You certainly don't see that much anymore."
The old man lifted his head in momentary interest. He looked at the old couple driving the spring wagon in mild surprise.
"I know those people," he said, slowly turning in his seat. "Those are the people who used to live down by Nagizi Trading Post in the Sand Wash. I went to help out a sing there a long time ago, a night chant for their son who was very sick, even helped with the sand painting.
That was when I was still studying to be Hatahli."
He shook his head sadly, looking down at his hands. "The night chant is a long sing. On the last day, the boy died."
Lucy looked over at her father, pursing her lips thoughtfully.
"Well, they must live around here now. They didn't drive that wagon very far, I bet. Do you want to stop and say hello? We got plenty of time."
The old man looked at his daughter as though she might be dull-witted.
"No, don't stop. I told you, their son died."
Lucy shrugged her shoulders and turned the battered pickup truck onto the highway, south toward the Great Shiprock. She hoped Thomas Begay would be waiting at the La Plata Bridge. He hadn't been there this morning, though that was where she usually picked him up after one of his all-nighters. She hadn't stopped to look under the bridge coming into town this morning. If he was under there, it would mean he was still drunk, and she didn't care to deal with that. When he sobered up, he would be standing by the bridge waiting for a ride, if not from her, from someone who didn't know him. That might take a while.
"Where is Thomas?" the old man suddenly asked as though reading her mind. "Is he drunk?"
The old man took a perverse pleasure in needling her about Thomas Begay and his drinking. He did this, she supposed, in retaliation for the shame she had brought upon the family. The truck squealed as she pushed in the clutch, looking for the last gear. Something about the throw-out bearing, Thomas had said. That's what's making it squeal. This truck wouldn't last much longer. One of these days it would just lay down on them like an old horse, and that would be the end of it. She had enough money put away for a better truck when the time came, but she wanted to get all the good out of this one first. Lucy Tallwoman was not frivolous with her money.
Thomas Begay being the only luxury she afforded herself. Thomas Begay was becoming painfully sober as he floated inexorably down the river, hidden among the branches of the cottonwood. Never had he suffered such a hangover. He felt like he had been run over, chemically speaking. The cold green water of the San Juan lapped at his trembling lips, and he sipped a little from time to time to ease his parched throat and pounding head. His hands, pale and wrinkled, clutched at the tree branches in front of his face. His legs, numb from the waist down, could no longer feel his feet bumping along the bottom. It was only a few miles from the hospital bridge to the confluence of the San Juan and La Plata, and he forced himself to watch the western shorelines for signs of the approaching juncture. If he could maintain his frigid grip on the log, he would, at some point, swing in very close to where his drunken slumber had been so rudely interrupted earlier in the morning. He studied the face of his black plastic watch through the swirling water. The American flag on the dial seemed to be waving in the current, and the little second hand was clicking along splendidly. These watches really could take a licking and keep on ticking, he thought. The watch, a blue light special, had been a good buy at $14.95, and yet Lucy Tallwoman had chided him for his extravagance. It crossed his mind that maybe sometime he would write the company a little note, telling them of his experience with their product, and maybe be on one of those TV commercials. Maybe they could have a stuntman do this part in the river. It appeared to be only 10 o'clock, according to the squiggly black hands, which meant only 3 hours had passed since his arrest, and here he had come nearly full circle. Soon Lucy Tallwoman would be coming by on her way home with the groceries and her father. They would be looking to pick him up as they had done in the past. He had no more than thought this when the river began its slight bend to the west, and then the distance he could see, suspended between cobalt sky and a shimmer of golden cottonwoods, the shining concrete of the La Plata Bridge. Lucy Tallwoman pulled the old truck across the traffic lane to the riverside of the road and parked on the pull-off just before the bridge. She sat there a moment in the warm October sun, listening to the rhythmic ticking of the engine as it cooled. Her father, who had been dozing, opened one eye. Looking around, he immediately recognized the bridge as their pickup point for Thomas Begay.
"So where is bad boy Begay?" he said in English, using his made-up name for Thomas. "Still passed out under the bridge?"
"I don't know. I haven't looked under the bridge yet," Lucy Tallwoman replied, leaning her head out the window, tapping the fingers of her left hand on the roof of the truck. She was beginning to hope that Thomas Begay had already hitched a ride with someone foolish enough to stop, though she considered this unlikely. "Look, there's a police car up ahead and some men measuring or surveying or something down in the wash." She shot the old man a concerned look. "You don't think something has happened to Thomas, do you?"
"I doubt they would be measuring Thomas," the old man replied. "Much as I would like to hear it."
He stared straight ahead.
"Do you want me to go look under the bridge?"
He spoke more gently now and turned to his daughter with a half smile.
"Maybe a little kick from behind will get him started off right this morning."
Lucy Tallwoman smiled back. "I'm sure you would enjoy that. But for the sake of peace on a Sunday morning, I'll go look for Thomas Begay." As she reached for the door handle, there came a hiss from the underbrush, causing her to jump, hitting her head on the window frame. "Psst!" it came again, a sound so pronounced that even her father's old ears had no trouble hearing it. The old man rolled his eyes heavenward, shaking his head.
"Tell me it's a snake and not Thomas," he sighed.
Lucy Tallwoman peered into the brush beside the truck. Some branches rattled and twigs with leaves began to move upward out of the bar ditch.
"Don't move," the twigs whispered. "Don't say anything. Act regular."
Lucy turned to her father. "It's him," she said in a small voice. "He has twigs on his head."
"Now what?" the old man said in a tired whisper. "Has he gone completely away or what?"
"Get out and pretend to check the oil," the twig said, almost at the edge of the road. "Leave your door open and the hood up until I'm inside." Lucy Tallwoman, sensing the urgency in Thomas Begay's voice, moved to the front of the truck, leaving her door open and blocking the view from up the road. She was beginning to piece things together. Covertly, she looked toward the police car as she raised the hood and played at checking the oil. She watched, fascinated, as the pile of brush slithered up from the ditch and into the floorboards of the truck. Trying not to hurry, doing her best to appear nonchalant, she closed the hood and climbed back into the driver's side of the truck. She did not look at the mass of twigs and leaves, even now, sticking up above the dashboard. Her father sat quietly, peering at her through the thin screen of foliage that now separated them. She shook her head at him, placing a forefinger to her lips. The pile of twigs shuddered with relief as the truck pulled out onto the highway and crossed the bridge for home. No one looked at the men with the measuring devices.
2. The Gun.
Charlie Yazzie's government truck was playing one of its old familiar tricks, the engine cutting in and out, sputtering, choking, forcing Charlie to shift down into second gear and rev the motor unmercifully. He hated it when it did this. It put him on edge to know that he might have to walk out of the back country. It was inevitable, of course, just a matter of time, as they say. The truck was an agency hand-me-down, far past its prime. The reservation roads had already taken their toll. The people in charge of the motor pool had done their best but couldn't seem to pinpoint the problem, couldn't seem to tell if it was in the electrical or the fuel system, though Charlie had insisted it was the former. It would never act up on test drives, only when Charlie was 40 miles from nowhere, and 40 miles from nowhere was where he was now. He had chosen to take the back way into Lucy Tallwoman's camp, hoping to avoid detection on the long open flats leading to their camp from the highway. This road, trail really, ran up Big Sand Wash and came in from the high hills behind the camp, allowing him to remain hidden, maybe slip up on them. Oh, they would be on the lookout all right, but hell, he was an Indian too. Charlie's clan was Bit-Ani, the within-his-cover people. He was still 2, maybe 3 miles from the camp when the truck finally gave up, lurching to a choking halt in a slight depression in the wash. Charlie cursed in English, as there are no really good Navajo curse words. "You sorry son of a bitch," he said, getting out of the truck. "No good bastard." Charlie had always preferred Chevrolets, and his resolve was now strengthened in that direction. He kicked the truck in the driver's side door and, scooping up a rock, flung it through the open window. Some people thought Charlie Yazzie a little high-strung for a Navajo. "I'm going to get me a new Chevy," he whispered, gritting his teeth, knowing it to be an idle threat. After walking around the vehicle several times, saying bad things to it in Navajo, Charlie calmed down enough to get in and try the two-way radio. Nothing. The radio was dead. "So it is in the electrical," Charlie allowed himself a grim smile of satisfaction at this. He sat there, his mind a clutter, thinking what to do, thinking about Lucy Tallwoman and Thomas Begay. Why did these people still isolate themselves so, clinging to the old things, the old manner of living? Charlie had spent so long a time away at school that he had forgotten much of the old ways, leaving a vague dissatisfaction with those who would not better themselves. He thought of Patsy Greyhorse. Now there was a modern Indian, head of a government committee in Washington, traveling all over the country, looking into important issues. There was a life a person could take pride in, a way to be somebody, to make a difference. Why did these people want to live out here with no running water, no electricity, herding sheep for a living, if it could be called a living? They had been to school, seen the things the Biligana way had to offer. Still, they clung to this hard life and their superstitious ways. There's no accounting for it, he thought. Sliding over to the passenger side, he opened the glove box and pulled out a revolver, a .38 S&W Chief Special, with turquoise-set grips. It had been a present from his family when he became an investigator. It was stainless steel. "You can store this thing in a toilet tank if you want to," the salesman told them. "It's totally impervious to rust." None of them had a toilet tank, but they smiled and agreed that might come in handy sometime. They had visions of Charlie rounding up a lot of crooks with that gun. Wrong. He had fired it only a few times at some tin cans. He was not a very good shot. Rummaging further in the glove box, he came up with just 4 cartridges, which he inserted into the cylinder, easing the hammer down on the one empty chamber. The 125-grain slugs gave a nice little heft to the gun, and he spun it on his trigger finger to get the feel of it. Charlie had no intention of shooting anyone. It just seemed to be the professional thing to do, having this gun. 4 bullets would be plenty, he thought.
sneaking through the cedars and scrub oak. He worked his way through the dry...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?